This week on the show, oh, what a weekend we have to recap. Nick Chelso of CLNS Media joins us to talk about the maybe Celtics-Cavs trade, what's going on with Kyrie. Bill Spiros, you know him as obnoxious Boston fan, writes for the Herald. He'll break down the Patriots post-Julian Edelman injury. And Adam Jones of 98.5, the Sports Hub, will tear apart a brutal weekend for the Boston Red Sox. All that, Mayweather-McGregor, and more, calling it, starts right now. Well, what a weekend that was. Patriots preseason game, Red Sox shellacking, Mayweather-McGregor, VMAs even. But to me, the biggest story, the most out there story, was the Boston Celtics. I'm Alex Barth. He's Alex Lovewitz. You're listening to the Callin' It podcast. On the phone with us now from CLNS Media is Nick Chelso. Nick, have you even wrapped your head around all this yet? Like, what's going on here?
Guys, this is not even a story. Like, I'm completely annoyed by the whole thing. Like, do you want it? First of all, Dan Gilbert's calling the shots here. I mean, this kid, GM, is getting, I believe, this guy, I have no sources here, but I believe he's getting pushed around by LeBron and Gilbert. And, I mean, truthfully, I don't feel like, you know, the ESPN report last night, it was a segment during SportsCenter. And Woj gave the segment, and it was mainly around the Cavs wanting more for Irving. You know, he had mentioned Tatum and Brown. Now, we all know that's going to get denied if they even go there. But the point of the story was that the Celtics are probably willing to offer a late first-rounder or a second-rounder, if anything. And ESPN, I don't know who titled that blog post or that column, but it really was misleading in regards to, you know, what the plans are going on. Now, let's just take this for a second. There is zero coming out of the Celtics camp. They are tight-lipped, and Woj has never been piped in with Danny Ainge, right? So Woj is basically acting as a press secretary for the Cavs at this point. I mean, that's my honest opinion, and I have a hell of a lot of respect for Wojnarowski, but I mean, that whole report ruined my Sunday night because it was tweet after tweet after tweet questions, you know, fans freaking out. In negotiation, you're going to ask for as much as you possibly can get. Danny Ainge is going to laugh and hang up the phone. I don't see how that's a story. I mean, to me, it was like what ESPN does so very well, which is, you know, take the obvious over or repackage the obvious in a way that you can really, really sell it. And that's exactly what they did. They sold a bogus report on a dead NBA day, and it blew up Twitter.
Well, let me ask you this. You talked about the Celtics camp being quiet, and they have a history of using the media very well, Steve Beaupet and company.
The Boston media.
Right. Are you surprised it's been so quiet on the Celtics front, and what does that tell you?
I was just talking about this with Justin Poulin from Celtics Stuff Live this morning. I don't know that I'm surprised. I'm actually taking some comfort in the fact that they are so muted. I mean, in a trade that originally had looked, and it was a bad face for Boston because Isaiah is loved and, you know, Crowder's mother, and it just looked really ugly when it happened. But at this point, if I'm a GM in the NBA, and I'm diverting, I'm gonna answer your question in a second. But if I'm a GM in the NBA, I'm not dealing with Altman. I'm not. He's right now, it's best like playing poker, I mean, or blackjack. If you cheat, you're kicked out of the casino. You know what I'm saying? So I mean, it's like he was aware. I am certain, because I've talked to a numerous amount of people in Boston, that he was fully aware of the injury.
So you think this was a negotiation ploy by the Cavs?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a tweet by Woj, the press secretary for LeBron, saying, like, right after he broke the rumor broke that it was the trade was going to happen, him saying that the Cavs are fully aware of Isaiah's injury and are comfortable with his recovery time. So what happened between then and last week? I mean, honestly, Danny Ainge may be shrewd, but he's not going to ruin his credibility by trying to sell a bad bag of goods to a team that's going to be able to fact check him the minute they give Isaiah the physical. So he was absolutely, I'm certain he was honest about it, the injury, and I'm certain now it's a negotiating tool. And you know, I mean, Altman is a kid. I mean, he's making a splash in the NBA right now, basically putting his feet down and saying, yeah, next year I have to rebuild the Cavaliers when LeBron leaves. And the NBA's best GM, Danny Ainge, is not going to push me around. And I think it's backfiring on them. I think right now it's gone from what was a PR nightmare for the Celtics originally to, I think, astute NBA fans. And I think the media eventually will turn this around, and it will look bad for the Cavaliers if they void this trade. And if they void the trade, boys, I mean, Phoenix, if I'm Phoenix, I immediately reduce my interest in Kyrie because his value is so diminished based on his demands. He's not going to show up for training camp. I mean, at this point, Danny Ainge, that 2018 pick and Jay Crowder truly should have been enough.
So if this trade does fall through, who's it worse for from a roster standpoint? Is it worse for the Celtics to have to send Isaiah Thomas and Jay Crowder back to Boston, or is it worse for the Cavaliers, from a player morale standpoint, to send Kyrie back to Cleveland?
I think it's equally bad. I mean, both have nothing more really to offer in this deal, and both have as much to lose. I mean, the Cavs have a situation where LeBron, short of them winning the NBA title, which they're not going to do, LeBron is gone. He's gone. All right. Kyrie wants to be gone. So now you're looking at losing your two superstars with no number one, no top, you know, top protected pick from the Nets at 18. You have nothing to rebuild on then. And the Celtics standpoint, Jay Crowder had to go anyway. He has been unhappy. He's made it pretty clear. I mean, Jay, one thing about Jay is he doesn't hold anything back on social media. And, he's also been public about it during the season after Hayward came to Boston. I mean, I think it's a silly move by Crowder to want to be so unhappy when he's probably going to start alongside of Hayward if the trade were to void. But Crowder's pretty much got to go at this point. Isaiah, I mean, regardless of his feelings after all of this, he plays great with a chip on his shoulder, and it's a contract year. So I think it's only a matter of time before, you know, Isaiah, you know, just gets professional and reconforms. I'm not being a homer here. It would be pretty catastrophic to bring back two guys who did not want to leave in the first place and, you know, were forced to leave. And it's a bad morale. It's a bad situation with a brand new locker room coming in. But I truly believe they both have as much to lose. And the offer is good as is. And on it, quite honestly, I've spoken to some, I mean, I'm not going to be one of these source guys, but there's some people up in Boston that feel like the Celtics may make it very, very clear, even before the deadline, that they aren't offering any more regardless, which is basically like the Celtics saying, look, take the deal or don't, and then forcing the Cavs to forcing their hand, you know, call bluff. And if the Cavs will either say, yes, this is the best deal possible, go with it. That's what I believe will happen. Or the Celtics let the Cavs go off into negotiations with other NBA teams. But I got to be honest. I mean, if I'm another NBA team, I don't know if I'm dealing with them at this point, unless it's for LeBron. And you know, so I don't know, man. I mean, my heart tells me just to get this over with. And because of the glut of picks Ainge has, he may throw in second rounder. But I could honestly see Danny Ainge saying, no, the deal's the deal, man. I mean, if one thing we've learned about Ainge over the years is he has no problem saying no.
And we're talking to Nick Gelso of CLNS Media. So do you think this trade is going to stay as is? Ainge isn't going to offer anything else? So let's assume that that's the case, that this deal is...
He may offer a second rounder. I mean, just to get it over with, but I'm sorry to cut you off, but I just wanted to clarify that. Mm-hmm. I'm perfectly fine with, not that I matter, but I'm perfectly fine with Ainge completely calling, I'm going to say Dan Gilbert's bluff, because I feel like that nut job is the one who's pulling the strings here.
Let me ask you this. You talk about calling the bluff. Do Do you think Danny Ainge could play hardball and start taking pieces off the table, either protecting the Brooklyn pick, taking back Zizic?
I don't think he can, guys. I don't think he can because it's agreed to in principle. I think only the Cavs can alter the deal unless they void it and renegotiate.
So let's assume that the deal does go through. Cleveland gets Isaiah, Jay Crowder, that pick, and Zizic. You said it. LeBron's probably out the door after this upcoming season. What is the Eastern Conference going to look like when LeBron does leave Cleveland and when the Celtics do have this core together?
I mean, that's a really tough question because we don't know what the roster for either team is going to really look like if the deal goes through. I mean, which scenario are we looking at? Is the deal going through asking that question, or is it not going through?
Assuming it does go through.
Well, the East looks top-heavy just like it is right now. I mean, Cleveland just falls to the bottom of the pack, and Boston is the clear-cut favorite to reach the NBA Finals.
And is that – so it weakens the Eastern Conference. Are we looking at kind of the same thing we've seen the past couple years where you have the Western Conference and it's stacked up at the top and you have these teams like the Timberwolves on their way up, the Suns even – is it going to be they're just going to dominate and the Eastern Conference is going to have, you know, that one team that's going to be the clear-cut winner, clear-cut favorite, and it's just going to be a pile of garbage behind that?
Well, I mean, Washington is fun to watch. The Sixers are fun to watch. I mean, they're going to be fun to watch. I don't think it's the Bucks are going to be fun to watch. I don't think they could compete out West. When I was growing up, the Western Conference was a cakewalk, and the East was the powerhouse. I mean, the Lakers marched to the finals every single year, and it's just opposite now. I mean, the last 10 years, it's pretty much been a hot, top-heavy conference. I mean, I remember even in the Big Three era, it was always Boston, Cleveland, Orlando in the top three. And, I mean, it's just similar, only it's just more talent is going out West. So, yeah, it's lopsided, but it's lopsided no matter what.
One more question for you here, Nick, before we let you go. Why didn't Isaiah Thomas have hip surgery last year? That seems to be the holdup, and it seems like nobody was talking about it.
I don't understand. I don't know, and I don't understand it at all. I mean, obviously there must be some truth to the Celtics medical staff who have evaluated Isaiah, and I don't know if they could – I don't think they could force him to have surgery, but allowed him to, you know, without any argument that we know of to go without surgery. I mean, that's what I'm saying. If it's a severe injury, but if the injury was as severe as shockingly severe as the Cavs are making it out to be, that news would have come out prior to the trade. I mean, it would have leaked somewhere. You would have heard it somewhere. There would have been more speculation. I think the issue with Isaiah and Danny is Danny Ainge was never going to sign Isaiah to a max deal, and he was probably going to have to trade him at a very diminished value at the trade deadline, or he was going to walk. And I think the injury only cemented that in the way it's a concern for any player, but a player of Isaiah's size. Remember, guys, the Cavs wanted the 18 pick. That was what they really, really wanted in all this. And Danny kept throwing sweeteners on it because of Isaiah's injury, the concern over Isaiah's injury. So all this at this point, I think, is BS. I think it's a really, really bad look for the Cavs. And of course, I mean, the national media just adore the Cavs, so you're not going to hear that as much. But I believe it's a bad look for Cleveland. It's a bad look for their new GM. And I think it's Dan Gilbert at the heart of all this. Again, guys, all speculation here, but that's my feelings.
And Nick Gelso from CLNS Media. You can follow him on Twitter at CLNS Nick. And I'm sure you and the guys at Celtics Beat will have updates throughout this whole saga, whatever happens this week. Any end date in set for us to have a definitive answer on this?
Well, yeah, it's got to be by Thursday. I mean, that's the deadline. I know Thursday night we are filming with Jared Weiss and Jimmy Toscano. We're going to do a Garden Report in Boston to kind of recap whatever the decision is. But it has to be by Thursday. Now, I'm hearing it could be within the next 36 hours that Boston puts their foot down and says, we are not offering anymore. So don't be surprised if you hear that.
And for all the updates on that, clnsmedia.com at CLNS. Nick. Nick, thanks so much. I understand you're making your way to Beantown soon, so good luck with the move, too.
Hey, thanks, guys, and I'll see you in Boston.
For sure.
Later.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back into Calling It, Alex Barth and Alex Lebowitz. Well, that Celtics ordeal was going down the other night. The Patriots were playing their third preseason game of the year in Detroit. The big story out of that one, Julian Edelman torn ACL. He's done for the season. To help make sense of it, joining us on the phone from the Boston Herald, you know him on Twitter as Obnoxious Boston Fan, Bill Spiros joins us. Bill, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. I'm not quite sure if I'm doing better than Edelman since I had surgery last week myself, although I expect to be back before 2018. In Jewel's case, we know that's not the case, sadly.
Well, good to hear on your end, Bill. And, yeah, like you mentioned, out for the season. But is this loss going to hurt the Patriots as bad strategically as it does the fans emotionally? Is it as bad with X's and O's as it feels?
Well, there's two parts to that, at least I think. First of all, you know, we've all been brainwashed, dutifully so, I don't know what you want to call it, maybe the state institution, that, you know, next man up, next man up, next man up. And I think you can look at certain statistics and you can look at certain breakdowns, especially with this, the makeup of this roster, and you could say, okay, well, they can shift Chris Hogan underneath and maybe extend with Malcolm Mitchell or just give Danny Amendola more reps because, you know, you have the progression from Welker to Edelman to Amendola. And when Welker went down, we were having, you know, people were having the same conversation. What was it, 5 years ago, 4 years ago? You know, can they replace Welker? Can Edelman do what Welker did? Well, Edelman was better than Welker. He surpassed Welker because we all remember what Wes Welker didn't do in the Super Bowl with 4 minutes to play versus what Julian Edelman did in the Super Bowl with 2 minutes to play in terms of making that catch. So I think numerically, statistically, it's not going to be that much of a hit. Where they're going to miss Edelman is Brady's confidence. Edelman was his binky. And you can just focus on the second, you know, last 28 minutes of the Super Bowl. Not just simply the catch that he made with 2 minutes to play. There's no one on the team that makes that catch. So you could say there's the difference right there in the Super Bowl without Edelman and with Edelman. Without Edelman, they don't make that third down catch. Now, maybe they convert on fourth down, but, you know, they don't make that catch at that time. And really, you know, you talk about the emotions of that momentum swing. And you know, he makes the catch to down 8-2. He makes that catch, and you're like, oh, my God, they're going to win this game. I think a lot of people, I think you could ask the Falcons at that time, you know, if they want to be honest, and they probably look at the gap of that catch, oh, my God, we're going to blow this. So they don't have there's no one on the team. I don't know if Chris Hogan makes that catch because Edelman is, you know, Edelman has taken it to another level. I mean, the bromance, you know, almost like he's, you know, he gets the supermodel pregnant, Brady gets the supermodel. I mean, he's just taken it to an entirely different level. So there's like a next levelness with Edelman that they cannot replace. But who knows? I mean, I Malcolm Mitchell, you know, one of my jobs is I run a website that covers the University of Georgia, and I saw a little bit of him in the SEC. I mean, he's got all the skills of, you know, that deep threat that, you know, everybody's been lamenting since Randy Moss. We saw that in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl. Brady was going to Mitchell in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl. And he was talking about that today when he was doing his deal with Kirk and Callahan. You know, they asked him, obviously, the obvious question about next man up, and he rattled them off. You know, Danny and Chris and Malcolm. So, you know, I think Brady is comfortable with these guys, but I think there's just another level of comfort that he had with Edelman, you know, symbiotic. You know, almost, you know, sort of the way that the Spartans loved each other, but not quite that tight, that he doesn't have with these other guys. And, you know, I can't see them, you know, not being an offensive juggernaut given this roster that they have. I mean, where you could put Gronk and Chris Hogan and Malcolm Mitchell on the field and still have James White in the backfield at the same time. I mean, that's a pretty good offense. and good luck to you know, to anyone trying to stop it. Obviously, they're better with Edelman than without him. I mean, that's anyone who wants to make that point is an idiot. But are they? Is it a fatal flaw? Are they doomed? I don't think it kills them to get to the Super Bowl. I'm not sure about in the Super Bowl, in a situation like they were last year. I don't know if they win last year without Edelman, but at least to that point, I don't think it's going to make a difference.
Well, Amendola is also dating a supermodel. You forgot to mention him, so if you want to...
No, you're right. I mean, well, what would you do if you're Didi Amendola and you want to be next man up? I mean, we've seen Aaron Rodgers talk about doing the Brady diet thing. I read a story over the weekend about that.
Gronk's doing it now, too.
So you have a lot of... And it was a really interesting anecdote. I was watching the Jaguars feed of the game when they played Jacksonville, obviously living down here. And the Jaguars announcers were talking at length about how Blake Bortles was just in awe of watching Brady practice. And they were talking about Bortles, and he says, well, Blake saw that Tom Brady was wearing his pads during warm-ups. And so he told us, from now on, I'm going to wear my pads during warm-ups because Tom Brady's doing it. So, you know, you want to talk about the impact and influence that Brady has on everybody. So it probably goes from wearing shoulder pads during warm-ups to dating and impregnating Super Bowl. I think it's the wide spectrum of influence that, you know, Brady has on the team. And, I mean, you know, why not? I mean, you know, I follow Tom Brady. You know, I could probably stick to his diet for maybe 15 or 20 minutes until I got hungry. You know? I mean, this guy is like, oh, I can't eat strawberries because they're not healthy enough. And I need a strawberry. I said to my wife, yeah, I'm eating healthy. I'm eating strawberries, so I'm going to have another piece of pizza. In Brady's mind, the strawberry is probably worse than the pizza.
If he hadn't won 5 Super Bowls, people would think he's out of his mind.
Well, of course. Yeah, you can get away with a lot when you've won 5 Super Bowls. And you actually had the lead in the other 2 Super Bowls with less than 3 minutes to play. I mean, lest we forget that. So
trying
we know
to.
How close he is to winning 3 Super Bowls, but we also know how close he is to winning 7.
So how much more reliant will he be on the running back core with Edelman out? Not even with Edelman out, but with the new weapons you have who are so versatile. This obviously adds to it, but do you expect this running back core to be more involved in the pass game this year?
You know, that's a great question. Do I expect it more? I should. You should expect it more. All you have to do is, you know, see who was the real MVP of the Super Bowl, meaning James White. You know, they certainly used it against – and it's funny, I'm going back to the Super Bowl for a lot of these answers because, you know, there was never more a time. If you want to see Bill Belichick, like, unplugged or exposed or emotionally nude, watch what they did in the second half of that Super Bowl. That was, you know, the masterpiece of Belichick's coaching ability. So, you know, using that as a template, yes, we saw how they ran the ball. But, you know, remember, these are the Patriots. So their version of the running game is swinging James White out of the backfield on 3rd and 5 and throwing him a 6-yard pass. I mean, that's their, you know, this goes back to Bill Walsh and even Paul Brown, but even, you know, Bill Walsh in the 80s and the 49ers. You know, that was their version of the running game. And so for the Patriots, when you say, are they going to run the ball more? I would say yes, but that, in my mind, means they're going to be throwing swing passes to James White and whoever else is set back there. You know, anything where Brady's not going to be hit, you know, on 3rd and 6 or 3rd and 4, and he's stepping back to throw a quick out to James White, he's not going to get hit. If he gets hit, it's going to be a penalty because he's going to have the ball out in like 1.4 seconds. So in that sense, I agree. I like your premise, and I like your question. You know, what you would call a traditional running set, I just don't see the Patriots employing that anymore. They've done it a lot the last couple of years. So I don't, you know, with Blount last year, I mean, he finally got gassed in the Super Bowl, but, you know, he had a tremendous year. They wore him down. So I don't know if they do it any more than that, but I think they've been doing it quite a bit more than they had been, you know, I think primarily to protect Brady.
Again, we're talking to Bill Spiros, obnoxious Boston fan, also of the Boston Herald. Also, Bill, like you said, covers the SEC. So you probably got a chance to watch a good amount of Cyrus Jones in college. Probably the most electrifying kick returner since Tyrann Mathieu. Hasn't been the same in New England. Now he seems to be one of these bubble guys for the roster. Can he return to form as a kick returner? Can he become the guy for the Patriots that he was at Alabama? Or is he just damaged goods at this point?
Well, you know, he's still on the team. I mean, I don't know, you know, when obviously they got a couple more cuts. I think Belichick wants to give this guy the benefit of the doubt. And then some. Given his pedigree, you know, I'm sure I would not be surprised if, you know, he called Nick Saban and said, you know, what's the deal with this guy? And, you know, if his feedback has been, hey, you know, this is uncharacteristic and he's, you know, it's an, I we're talking about this on the Herald a couple of weeks ago with Christian, and, you know, it's funny because after one exhibition game, this guy was finished. Oh, he's finished with the Patriots. He's finished. And then he, you know, he had it played well. I mean, the guy played at Alabama. So I'm not concerned about his ability to handle the situation. I think he's got the physical skills. He's got the background. He's got the pedigree. You know, and Belichick loves guys that come out of programs like Georgia and Florida and Alabama because they're system programs. And obviously the offenses are different, the specifics are different, but the program is similar to how the Patriots run things. Kirby Smart went to Foxborough. Kirby Smart is coach of Georgia, used to coach for Nick Saban. He went to Foxborough in this past offseason to sit in on some of the OTAs in the spring. And, you know, his mantra, he came back to Athens, and his mantra was, do your job. Seth Emerson's our beat writer is a great guy at DogNation.com if you want to read him. And you know, he wrote a whole piece about how Kirby Smart came back to Athens after spending 3 days in Foxborough, and his whole thing was do your job. You know, so obviously when Belichick looks at a guy from Georgia who's played for a guy who coached for Nick Saban and is telling his players, oh, do your job, he knows this guy's got the mindset. And if you play in the SEC, I'm obviously biased. My son, having just received his degree from the University of Florida, if you play in the SEC, you can handle the physical issues. You can handle the, you know, the practices. They don't do two-a-days now anymore, obviously, but you can handle that stuff. You can handle the organizational issues, you know, saying the right things, being part of the team and all that stuff. I mean, these programs are super, super, super structured. And they're very similar to the way that the Patriots run, the way that Belichick runs his football team, which is why he loves these guys. Because he knows that, you know, to get to, you know, Cyrus Jones, he knows there's no other issue there except for the fact that, you know, there's some physical ability to hold on to the football. It's nothing else. It's not like an emotional thing. It's not like a Coney Ealy thing where this guy's a project or a problem. It's more like, you know, okay, dude, just calm down and make the catch. But once he gets past that initial, you know, nerves, whatever you want to call it, because it's the NFL, I mean, he's got all the tools. And I think Malcolm Mitchell does too. I tell you, Malcolm Mitchell, this guy is, you know, he's got the potential to be as good as anyone, you know, especially with Tom Brady throwing him the ball. And, you know, so you got him and Gronk, it's like, hey, what are you going to do?
He is Bill Spiros. You can read him at the Boston Herald. You can follow him on Twitter at RealOBF. Bill, thanks so much for coming on Talking Patriots with us.
Oh, thanks, guys. Anytime. Anytime.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
All right. So, well, the Patriots were losing key players and the Celtics were in the middle of whatever that was with the Cavs over the weekend. Maybe the luckiest team in Boston was the Red Sox, because nobody saw them get absolutely destroyed by an Orioles team that has been nothing but subpar this year. But they didn't evade our eye. We will talk about it. Another person who saw it and wants to talk about it is Adam Jones from 98.5 The Sports Hub. He's on the phone with us. Adam, how you doing?
What's up, guys? Good weekend for the Red Sox, huh?
Fantastic weekend. What happened? Is this the real Red Sox team? Did they show their true colors this weekend?
So look, I mean, I have been saying for a while that I don't think this team is going to go on a deep run in the playoffs. And what I mean by that is just win a round, right? If they're in an ALCS or they're in the World Series, like that qualifies as a deep run to me. Making the playoffs and losing in the first round, that can't possibly be considered that. So if you look at what they did a year ago, I think they're a better team just based on Chris Sale at the top of the rotation. I think they're a better team this year than they were a year ago, even without David Ortiz. I still think they're going to win the division. You know, I think with all their flaws and all of the problems that the Red Sox have, I still think they're the most complete team in the AL East, more so than New York, certainly more so than that Baltimore team that swept them over the weekend. But I don't know how deep of a run this team's going to go on. You know, I think the flaws are evident when it comes to the lineup and when it comes to clutch hitting, when it comes to some of their biggest bats going, you know, ice cold at inopportune times, whether it's Mookie Betts or Xander Bogaerts or Hanley Ramirez, right on down the list. I think this team's flawed. I don't think it's going on a deep run, but I do think it's the strongest team in the division and probably the number three team in the American League after Houston and Cleveland.
And you mentioned Chris Sale. I think the last three of five starts for him, he's given up at least four earned runs. And you compare it to his July, he gave up four earned runs in that entire month. When do we start worrying about Chris Sale?
So, I mean, I don't think you need to worry about him in terms of, you know, morphing into a replacement level pitcher. I think the concerns are, can he be the same guy you just referenced in July, or the same guy he was for the first 4 months of the year, where he was the, I think, American League front runner for the Cy Young. I mean, even more so than Corey Kluber, who's kind of tightened up that gap. I think based on April through July, Sale was your Cy Young. And he'd probably still get my hypothetical vote today, even with his last start and his last couple of starts against Cleveland. That said, over the course of his career, he has tended to become more average, especially by his standards, in the months of August and September. He's never pitched in October. If he makes it to October this year, the most likely opponent is going to be the Cleveland Indians, who he has his worst numbers against for his career and two horrible starts against them this year, both in the month of August. He allowed seven runs in both of them, six earned last time out. I think there's cause for concern there. I don't think he's going to turn into, you know, Clay Buchholz or someone like that. I do think if he's not at, you know, his peak performance, I do wonder if this team can go on the run that maybe some forecast them to. And that's another thing to throw on the pile with their bad base running, with, you know, their underwhelming manager and all the other stuff that's gone on this year.
And even if he does bounce back, part of the question is who's the number two behind him. And it looks like it could be Drew Pomerantz. He's been good. But personally, I'm concerned. I'm wondering if you share the same concern. John Farrell has such a quick hook for him, and I know his pitch count will get up there, but he had a good start last week and was pulled after 5 1/3 with 80-something pitches. Why is John Farrell so quick with him, and do you think that's something we could see in the playoffs?
I absolutely think it's something we'll see in the playoffs, and I go back and forth on this one because Pomerantz has this extensive injury history, and he's not very efficient with his pitches. And if you let him go out there and throw 110, 120 pitches, I don't know that that's going to instill, you know, any good habits in him. If you ever want to break him of being a five-inning pitcher with 100 pitches, then the way to do it is kind of send the message that, hey, if you don't clean it up, if you're not more efficient, especially in the regular season, you're going to get a quick hook. You know, all of that said, he's definitely the number two for me. And I've always been on board with that trade since it happened. I've been a fan of him since they acquired him. The innings are a concern, though. And if you're going to need to piece together three or four innings out of your bullpen every time he gets a start in postseason, that's opening up the soft underbelly of most teams, and this Red Sox team specifically, especially since they're afraid to go to Craig Kimbrell, it seems like, or he is unwilling to do more than three outs in appearance. So, you know, maybe Farrell is just keeping the governor on for the regular season, and when we get to the postseason, he'll let him go deeper into games and throw more pitches, and they'll suffer with some of the inefficient outings more so. But, you know, right now I think this is the norm, and I think this is kind of who Drew Pomeranz is. You hope you get six innings out of him and then turn it over to the bullpen for three. I think that's kind of been the formula all year long.
Doug Fister's a guy who's had back-to-back great starts this season. Where do you see – how do you see his role shaping up down the stretch? And if David Price does come back, what do you think they do with him? Do they stick him in the bullpen or continue to throw him out there?
So I'll start with the Price stuff first. I think that's very interesting. I'm trying to remember who wrote about that last week. Michael Silverman, I think, in the Boston Herald. But one of the beat writers wrote about this last week, and I thought – it's interesting if David Price is on board, right? I mean, he's pitched pretty well out of the bullpen in the past. He did it against the Red Sox in the 08 ALCS when he was a rookie, so that was different, you know, status for him, and he was just getting to the big league. He also did it for Toronto a couple of years ago. I forget if it was 14 or 15, whatever year it was. So he has some experience doing that. He's done pretty well out of the bullpen. You know, is he going to want to do that? And are the Red Sox going to want to stick a $31 million arm in the bullpen? I mean, I think you can explain it away by saying, hey, you know, we couldn't get his pitch count up. There's no more minor league affiliates to send him to kind of do an extended spring or get any relief rehab appearances under his belt down in Pawtucket or Portland or anything like that. I know the Indians did something similar with Danny Salazar last year, so maybe you can look at it that way. I think Price, based on his track record in the postseason, he's not really a guy I want on the mound starting a game, so I would be open to the bullpen for him. I just don't know if he'd want to do it, and I don't know if the Red Sox and, you know, specifically ownership, putting David Price $31 million a year, I don't know if they can stomach that. On Fister, I stick him in the bullpen. You know, he's a long man, mop-up guy. I think he's done exactly what you wanted him to do, and I think it's why the idea of trading Clay Buchholz and it would come back to bite the Red Sox, I thought that was laughable at the time. There are so many replacement-level guys out there, like a Doug Fister who you can plug in, who costs you nothing, and who isn't a mental case, who isn't, you know, someone who seems like they're about to go on the DL every outing. So I think Doug Fister gave you exactly what you were hoping for, maybe even a little bit more than that. I know he had a rough start here in Boston, but I would not leave him in the rotation in the postseason. I would stick him in the bullpen, and that's if he's even on the playoff roster. I think you've kind of gotten what you want out of him to this point.
Again, we're talking to Adam Jones of 98.5 The Sports Hub. The other big name on the disabled list right now is Dustin Pedroia. Given how well Eduardo Nunez has hit, Rafael Devers has hit, what's waiting for Pedroia when he comes off the DL? Is it his second base position back? Is it as a designated hitter? Is it as a platoon player? Has his standing been shaken by how well the team has played while he's been out?
So I think the only question is, can he play second base every day? Like, can his knee and his injury situation hold up to it? I think if he can, he's back at second base. I mean, that's my personal opinion. I know Nunez and Devers both have hit really, really well, and the team has been fine without him to this point, at least last weekend aside. I saw a stat today. I think it was from Scott Lauber or one of the guys over at ESPN Boston. I think they have the fifth worst OPS at second base since Pedroia went down. So, I mean, you can kind of twist numbers however you want, and that's not a very complete look at all the statistics, but I think you can use Pedroia's bat. I think he's a guy that, you know, all the leadership questions aside, I think he goes out there and he competes in the postseason. He's one of the few guys who's been there before in the postseason who can lead the team. So I think if he's healthy enough, he's at second base every day, and if you need to spot him at DH and have him get some starts there, that's what you do. But I think he's more than a platoon player, assuming he can hold up to it. I think he's in your lineup every day, again, health permitting.
So after three against Toronto this week, which they really should take care of, the Red Sox have a four-game series with the Yankees. Their last series of the at least of the regular season, we'll wait and see what happens. This time next week, who's leading the American League East?
I still think the Red Sox. I don't trust the Yankees. You know, I know that they've gone through a couple of down periods and they've tended to bounce back. I don't love their pitching. I look at their rotation. I look at all the struggles in their bullpen, and I don't trust them. I know they have a better lineup. They in theory should have a better bullpen than the Red Sox do. There's more big name arms out there, but a lot of them are struggling. You know, the guys they got from the White Sox, Robertson and Canley, have not been lights out, though Robertson's been better. You know, Chapman's been demoted. Betances I don't trust. So I look at the bullpen, and I think there's all kinds of question marks. You know, Tanaka's rounded into form, but he's sort of like David Price. You know, he's always one pitch away from throwing his arm out. I know that Severino's been excellent this year when he's been out there, which has been most of the season. I think Sonny Gray has been a decent enough addition to them, but I still don't trust most of their pitching. I don't like that side of their team. The lineup's legit, and if the lineup is going to bash all weekend over Labor Day, and maybe I could see the Yankees coming back and closing that gap, but I expect the Red Sox to beat up on Toronto here these next 3 days, and then, I don't know, at least split with New York over the weekend, and I think with that formula, they'll still be in first after Labor Day.
Yes, yeah, so you kind of answered this, but do you think the Red Sox can do enough this weekend to put this thing away and give themselves the spacing they need in September to get David Price back into shape, get Pedroia back into shape, work in some of these younger guys, and have some of these games maybe not be as important down the stretch?
I don't know. You know, it doesn't feel like the Yankees are going away to the point where the Red Sox would be able to win it comfortably. Like, I think they're going to win it. And, you know, I don't see it coming down to, like, the last weekend, do or die. Red Sox need to take, you know, two or three on that final weekend. But I don't know that they're ever going to put the Yankees away enough to the point where they can, you know, try skipping Chris Sale extra days to get him rest down the stretch, or, as you said, toy around with the usage with David Price or Dustin Pedroia. I don't get the sense they're that comfortable. I mean, I feel pretty confident they'll win the division. I think when you have whatever they had before the weekend, 4.5-5-game lead, I don't want to say it's insurmountable. We all saw in 2011 what happened with this team, but it feels pretty close to that, and it feels like it's a gap that I don't necessarily see being made up. So I would wager on the Red Sox winning this division. I don't know that it's going to be so comfortable where they can kind of start tinkering around and toying with things and have the division wrapped up midway through September.
Wouldn't you rather it be close, though, considering what we saw last year with how they kind of went into the postseason a little complacent and it carried over? Isn't it better if it is close down the stretch between them and the Yankees?
Yeah, I mean, I think you do see that periodically, not just in baseball, but other sports. You know, the wild card in football often, you know, a team that's battling down to the last weekend of the year and seems to be playing their best football when they need it and playing meaningful games. You know, they tend to go on a run, whereas the teams that sit around can get a little complacent. Maybe the Patriots side, they tend to do well coming off a bye week. I think you've seen that before in baseball, too. You know, the wild card winner gets a little bit of momentum, and then next thing you know, they're on a run. So I think you can look at it a couple of different ways. I mean, if you're really dinged up and you need to sit guys down to get them healthy, then I think that that's something I wouldn't be too concerned about. I'm not quite sure that's what the Red Sox are going to be doing. They've already been without players. They'd be easing guys back in. So, yeah, I mean, maybe if the Yankees are pushing them, that has them playing their best baseball and being focused and competitive down the stretch as opposed to throttling down, getting lackadaisical, and then next thing you know, maybe they're swept out in three games like they were a year ago.
Yeah, hopefully no more walk-off loss champagne celebrations. One more question for you, Adam. Who had the worst weekend in Boston? Which team?
Oh, good question. It's probably the Red Sox. I mean, when you get swept three straight games and all of a sudden your big comfortable lead is down to 2.5, obviously that's not ideal. I mean, I wouldn't say any team had a particularly good weekend. The Patriots, I think, are good enough to weather the storm without Julian Edelman. And when I say weather the storm, I mean they could still win a Super Bowl without Julian Edelman. You know, they won without Gronk a year ago. I think Gronk is more important to the offense than Edelman. I know not everyone feels that way. So I think they can overcome that. I think the Cavs news on that trade is frightening, but I still think at the end of the day, the deal gets done. The Celtics will only have to add something minor to the trade, if anything. If that deal gets undone, then I would put the Celtics at the top of the list. But no, when you get swept three straight games at home against a team that was dead and out of the playoffs, it seemed like, and now all of a sudden, you have the Yankees getting life breathed into them in a big four-game set over Labor Day weekend. I think that's the team that had the worst weekend. But I'll tell you what, no one really had a good one.
I'll say this. I was waiting for the Bruins to trade Pastrnak. I was expecting that notification to come any second.
Yeah, that would have skyrocketed them to the top of the list. If you're giving up on a 20-year-old kid who already is almost at a point per game and one of the electric players, one of the electric young players in the league, yeah, that would probably put him at the top
of the list. Still no contract, though. Still no contract.
Nope.
He's Adam Jones. You can follow him on Twitter at AdamJones985 from 98.5 The Sports Hub. Thanks so much for coming on. Hopefully, when we talk to you next time, clear skies.
All right, sounds good. Thanks again for having me.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Okay, so we got that nuts Celtics sort of trade thing.
Yep.
Edelman tears his ACL.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Sox got shellacked.
You can say that again.
But you enjoy the fight. I enjoyed the fight this weekend.
Yes. It lived up. I don't know. It was exceeded the hype.
Oh, yeah. It was beyond the hype.
Yeah.
Alex Barth, Alex Leibowitz, you're listening to the Callin' It podcast. Yeah, I said on the show a lot, Floyd's just going to run. That's what he does. The upset of the night was that Floyd came to fight. He was throwing. They were going at each other.
McGregor landed some shots. People thought that wouldn't even happen.
McGregor won a couple of rounds, in my book.
First three, I think he won. First two, at least.
I gave him 2 and 3. I thought Floyd won the first round simply because even though McGregor landed a couple of shots, Floyd's defense in that first round was... He's so quick.
He missed a lot of shots, too, yeah.
He did. Yeah. But McGregor was winning after three rounds, which, as Floyd said numerous times after, that was the game plan, but... No, it was an entertaining night for boxing. It was a good night for boxing. Yep. The undercard was pretty good too.
Yep.
Gervonta Davis with the fluffy shorts, that was awesome.
That was ridiculous. I want to buy those shorts and just wear them out ironically.
We're going to see that hood as a meme for me getting ready for the blizzard tomorrow. Just wait until the first snowstorm of the year. You're going to see that picture everywhere.
And that plus the mask that Mayweather wore out. When you do something like that, like, if you lose, it's such a bad look.
To be fair, Deontay Wilder, who's the current heavyweight champion, he comes out with, like, a gold-plated
mask.
Yeah,
I've seen that.
Floyd, that's not Floyd's creation. He normally walks out with somebody, and I know him and Bieber had the falling out.
Yeah.
But maybe Lil Wayne, he walks out with Lil Wayne a lot. Somebody I was watching with pointed out, if he had walked out with Nate Diaz.
Oh, that would have been great.
I was really hoping for neither of the entrances were spectacular outside
of the
mask.
They don't do music. I didn't realize that's
no, they do. You couldn't hear it.
Okay.
There's music. Well, what Floyd normally does is Lil Wayne is rapping with him. Lil Wayne's actually performing whatever the song is.
You sure there was music?
There was some music. It's not like wrestling where it's a part of it. It's playing in the
arena.
Or
even the UFC, they have it banging.
I think there's just so much going on there that night that the commentators were talking over it.
Yeah,
they were just trying to set it up because you also had that delay. The pay-per-view issues. The issues were Floyd's people weren't happy how many people had bought it, so they gave him an extra half an hour. But I think it all kind of started. The fight started very quickly. I thought there was going to be about half an hour of lead up between the final undercard fight and the introductions, and there was maybe 10 minutes.
Yeah, it was pretty quick. They kept it going,
they got it moving.
Yeah, but it was a good fight. You know, the one thing that I didn't expect to happen was I didn't expect Mayweather to ever look uncomfortable. There were points where he looked uncomfortable.
Oh, he looked out of sorts. Well, first of all, I don't know how you react to that old-timey 1850s stance Conor McGregor had going.
It's like Popeye or something.
It was the Notre Dame mascot. But, yeah, there were times he looked out of sorts.
Yeah, and that's, you know, with the guy who's the greatest defensive boxer or one of them of all time. I know you have a gripe with that, but with a guy who has been as good as Mayweather historically, you wouldn't expect him to feel uncomfortable with someone who's never professionally boxed. And I think that speaks to his age, you know, the fact that he hasn't fought in 2 years, but it also speaks to how talented of a fighter, just flat out fighter McGregor is. And I think people underestimated him coming in.
No, Mayweather to me, strategy, he was more aggressive than I thought in terms
definitely.
Of what he brought. 40-year-old, hadn't fought in over a year. He was more or less what I expected.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he landed a lot of punches, there wasn't a lot of power behind him. I think we all saw that coming. To me, it was McGregor overperforming as opposed to Mayweather underperforming. And I think that's what ultimately made it a great fight, is McGregor elevated his level.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think part of that's because a guy like Mayweather may have been a little bit more aggressive. When you're that aggressive, you leave yourself open. And he said he was going to be more aggressive coming in. He said it was going to end it in a knockout, which it did. But you got a guy who's a defensive boxer. When you're trying to land these power punches, you know, you are vulnerable. And McGregor a couple times took advantage of that. And that's the only way I thought that he would have won, is if he landed a punch when Mayweather was being too aggressive.
Well, he kept going to the back of the head.
Yeah,
I thought he was going to get DQ'd. And you could see the UFC instincts kicking in, but that's what you didn't want, was for Mayweather to go down on one of those.
Do you think Robert Byrd, the ref, was too lenient with him? Do you think he should have taken off a point at some point? Or?
No, I thought he was about right.
Yeah.
For that fight, you kind of want to be a little more lenient. Mm-hmm. There's so much buildup. And one of them isn't a boxer. You don't want to be too technical. As for when he stopped the fight, I know some people are complaining.
He was done.
McGregor was out on his feet. And because it's such a high-profile fight, some people said, well, you should have let the knockdown play out. But if McGregor gets hurt, that's not a good look for boxing at all.
Yeah.
You needed to – McGregor, he hadn't thrown a punch in over a minute. Mm-hmm. If McGregor is that out but he's still managing to swing, it's one thing. But, no, he – I mean, you couldn't – not that you can understand Conor McGregor 90% of the time anyway, but you heard the way he was speaking after the fight. Jaw was
full,
broken.
Full Irish.
He was out of it. You needed to stop the fight at that point. But, you know, I'm excited now because I think, first of all, there's going to be a rematch. And I know Floyd said it's his last fight. They can make it an exhibition fight where it doesn't count against his record. He's still 50-0. There's no way McGregor will do it because McGregor's a competitor. Yeah.
And the money he'd get.
Well, that's why Mayweather will do it. He's not going to turn down a payday.
McGregor's going to get more money than he got this time, and the money he got this time is probably more than he'll get in his entire career as a UFC fighter.
This was supposed to be the first billion-dollar fight. I think they ended around $800 million. This is going – if they have a rematch, it will be a billion-dollar fight.
Oh, yeah.
Well over a billion.
And the thing is, McGregor didn't get knocked down. he didn't even get knocked down.
And so you can say – you know, they can come out and say, all right, well – Floyd's a year older. McGregor now knows what he's doing. He's been in the ring. I think a lot of people would watch that because so many people saw it as a joke this time, and it kind of was. If they have a rematch, it's not really a joke.
But isn't the mystique kind of gone? Like the thing, people were just curious to see, okay, Mayweather guys never box against Floyd Mayweather or McGregor guys never box versus Mayweather. Who's going to like, this is so, again, I use this word, it's gimmicky. Don't you think that like that kind of lust wears off?
Well,
it's not going to be the same appeal.
I think it's replaced. What I'm hoping as a boxing fan and somebody who wants to see the sport get more popular is that people saw that, appreciated what they were watching, saw a good fight, come away thinking, I want to see more than this. So the second time it's not a gimmick, it's, oh, this is going to be a good fight. I'll watch that. I'll watch a good fight. Mm-hmm. I think because they both fought so well, the gimmick goes away.
So... just in short, this is a win for boxing. Saturday,
absolutely
win for boxing.
Absolutely, I don't see how it's not. Everything went really. People weren't even complaining about the delay. Everything went according to plan. There really wasn't any trickery. Even on the undercards, you didn't have any bad decisions or anything. Mm-hmm. I know some people said that the Gervonta Davis fight was maybe stopped too early. It wasn't. That's how Gervonta Davis fights. He looks like he's losing for six rounds. 19 wins, 18 by knockout. It's like the episode of The Simpsons where Homer finds out that he can't get hurt if he's hit in the head. He lets the other guy just punch himself out and blows him over. That's who Gervonta Davis is. But no, it was and now we'll see. There's going to be a test September 17th, Triple G and Canelo. That's a huge fight. Hopefully, people saw that the Mayweather McGregor went home, did their research, understand what kind of fight this is. Mm-hmm. If that fight draws, we know boxing's on the way back up, and that fight should draw. That's going to be an awesome contest. Have Canelo, who came as close to beating Mayweather as anybody in the last half decade of his career, and you have Triple G, who's the reason that Floyd Mayweather retired. Mayweather can't beat this guy. That's why he won't come back. Everybody should be watching this fight. If you got the slightest inkling of excitement on Saturday night, watch Triple G Canelo September 17th.
Well, it also has to live up to the hype, so it has to be a fight that goes beyond the fifth round.
That's why the timing is so good. This is a fight that, by all intents and purposes, should live up to the hype.
Yeah.
These are two knockout fighters. It might not last long, but it's going to be spectacular.
Let me ask you this just before we end the segment. Negative or positive impact on the UFC this weekend?
I think not as negative as it should have been. It could be. If Conor decides to start boxing, it's a huge loss.
And especially with the John Bones.
Right, they're dealing with John Jones, too. It's a wash for them right now, I think. I mean, they got a little popularity for Conor, but if he leaves to start boxing, which some people... I think if anything, he would do both.
Yeah.
But...
he said he was going to return to UFC.
Right, and he's going to return short-term, but if he realizes the money's in boxing and he splits, that's a huge hit for Dana White. We won't know the ultimate UFC... outcome of this fight for probably about a year.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's going to do it for us real quick. Before we go, just a reminder to everybody. I know most of the people listening to the show are Patriots fans. We had a great time in Houston back in February. So let's return the favor. They need our help. Redcross.org. Everybody knows what's going on down there with the hurricane. Let's help those people out. Let's give whatever we can. The images coming out are spectacular. all the people going down there with their boats, really just in such a dark time, showing how good people can be. I think that's awesome. So Red Cross, or if you know any other way to donate, as Patriots fans, let's remember what we did in Houston, and let's go help them out a little bit.
Absolutely.
We will be back next week. So we'll have a recap of, I'm trying to think, is next week? Yes,
this
next
is
week.
Yankee series.
This Yankee weekend. Series, and we will have, we'll be talking Red Patriots first game of the year.
Week four.
This upcoming Sunday is the last Sunday without regular season football.
Yeah, so we'll be previewing
my weeks are
week
all
one.
Screwed up. Okay, so next week, huge show. This was a pretty big show,
this
so we'll have to
show,
top
yeah.
it. But next week, huge show. Be there for updates. Follow us on Twitter, at Calling It Podcast. Follow us on SoundCloud as well. You can follow him on Twitter.
Alex_Lebowitz.
I am at TheRealAlexB. There's a bunch of underscores. It's garbage. I made it in middle school. I need to change it. anyway, do all the social media stuff. We'll talk to you next week. Until then, this has been Calling It. Thanks for listening. Bye.